Now, we've come to our main speaker. Main speaker tonight is Matthew M. from California. Good welcome to him, please.
Hello, my name's Matthew. I'm an alcoholic. I can't even tell you how humbling it is to be here, how grateful I am. I hear Donna and Bruce last night and Richard from South Africa, when you read the steps, I thought you should read the steps at every AA meeting ever held, because you made me want to work them. And it's just a resonance about your voice, but it's just been so humbling to be here. Guido, thank you so much for communicating with me and keeping me in line to get here. And Charles, it's just been amazing spending the last few days with you around this town and your pride in this country. And I love Thailand. I've been here 2 days. And I have alcoholism, jet lag, and heat stroke. So you're going to get what you're going to get. And but I was also at the bilingual meeting today, and I got the hair on my arm stood up. And that young woman, Pai, spoke about being of service and how it changed her. And then other people around spoke about being of service. Just to hear AA in another language, so many thousands of miles from my home, working perfectly and beautifully, makes me realize how important this is, what an important work we do. Now, my wife and children stayed at home. Sometimes it's hard to make that trade-off. The only place I really ever want to be is at home with my wife and children. Come here to this beautiful place, realize that it's important. And I'm a relative newcomer. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of sobriety in here. My birthday at AA is May 16th, 1993. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag in Hermosa Beach, California. My prayer when I get up here is that I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like so you trust that I'm alcoholic and tell you a lot about what happened, what it's like now. And even if I do that, even if I'm successful doing that, I will be unsuccessful telling you what happened to me. Never quite been able to do it. Because it's such an internal thing for me. It's such a spiritual thing. Subtle and vast and rich. But I know you know. I know you know because I've felt it all around. I felt it by the pool and in the stories we've been telling each other and in the meetings and in the hotel. There's just energy here. So you know. So I'm forced to tell you the story. Because I really do want to talk about recovery, and my sobriety birthday is May 16th, 1993, I'm going to start with May 1st. Okay. It was really bad, you know. I weighed 108 pounds. I hadn't had a job in 7 months. I was sitting on my couch. I lived across the street from the ocean, and at night sometimes I'd wondered what that sound was. I did. I thought my screen door was slamming. I used to go check because we go, what's that weird sound? And that's honestly the truth. And I would sit on my couch drinking, and the mailman would come up on the porch, and I'd hold my breath because I didn't want anyone to know I was in there. And I didn't know it was the mailman. You know, I didn't have visitors. And I lived next door to a liquor store, and I was a musician for a long time, and I pawned my guitars and everything and anything to go to them. I'm the youngest of four in an Irish Catholic family, which is a wonderful place to grow up. And at the time, May 1st, my mother was dying of cancer a couple of miles from my apartment. And I would call her up and say, Mom, I'm going to come visit you today because I loved and respected my mother. And if you held a gun to my head and said, are you going to hang up the phone and visit your mom? I would say, absolutely. That's what I was going to do. And I'd hang up the phone and I'd walk towards the door and start realizing I was a little too thin. That I hadn't had a job in a while, and that I had warrants out for my arrest. And I forgot to mention there was a teenage girl pregnant with my child across town, and I was 31 years old, she was 18. And I would stop before the door, and I'd think, you know, I'm just going to have one drink. And then I'm going to visit my mom. And if you held a gun to my head and said, are you going to have one drink? I would say, yes, I'm going to have one drink. Just need to calm down. And, you know, I would, when I called my mother, she would always say the same thing. I'd say, I'm going to come visit you. She'd say, that would be lovely. And I went to visit my mom exactly 0 years. Started drinking. And you know, the way that whole thing, I was living a dream. I think all I need to say to qualify as an alcoholic is I was a rock and roll musician and I drank myself out of that job. That's what it was like. Now we can get on to recovery. I mean, that's hard to do, you know. The bar is so very low, and it's true. Right? The guy who kicked me out of the band had to drink half a bottle of Wild Turkey to get enough courage to kick me out of the band for drinking too much, and that's absolutely true. And I thought, you're kidding. I thought this was like the one job where I could do this, you know. And I lived on the East Coast when I did. I'm from California, and I lied, and I told everybody that I was coming back to California because my mother had cancer. Not true. Back to California because I had nowhere else to go. I got this job at this restaurant as a waiter, and I thought, you know, the reason I took the job, I had a degree, and I thought, I'll get this job as a waiter because if you're a waiter, you're still kind of an artist. You got options, right? So it's this place called Marie Callender's, and I got this job as it wasn't a sophisticated waiter, you know. And I thought the job was beneath me. And then they read my resume my second day and said, hey, you have a degree, and, you know, you want to be the manager. I thought, oh, no, you know, because then I'm a restaurant manager. You know, I'm not an artist anymore. And I thought that job was beneath me. You remember that? The job that was beneath you, but you consented to take it even though you had no other options. And I took this job that was beneath me, and it was funny. As I'm walking around, they're training me, and they're going, you know, here's the schedule for the cooks. Here's the combination to the safe. Here are the keys to the bar. And then the guy just kept talking, you know. And I'm like looking at Excalibur, like, bah! You know? And I suddenly thought, this job is perfect for me, you know. And then they introduced me to all the waitresses who were 17 and 18 years old, and I had the keys to the bar. And, you know, I'm an English major, but I can do math. And I figured, so cool, right? So the way I managed this restaurant is I would hover over the last customers praying they'd leave, you know, because they were in the way. And then we'd lock the door, and the girls would come up to the bar and drinks around the house. And the plan was to go home with somebody, right? And sometimes that happened. Rarely that happened. It wasn't that they would come up to me at 2:30 in the morning and go, hey, we have a hot tub at our new apartment. Why don't you come over? And I'd be like, why would we? Here, you know, there's a lot of alcohol here, and I'd fall asleep in the bar, you know, they fired me. I was so surprised that, you know, I was surprised. I'm like, you can't fire me, this job's beneath me, you know, that's really what I thought. But right when they fired me, this waitress said, I'm pregnant. I said it with a lot more depth than you did, but you know, I'm about to alienate all the women in the room, but I want to be honest about who I was. If you had lined up the waitresses at this restaurant and said, which one do you want to accidentally be pregnant? I said, not her. Okay? And she was 18 years old, I was 31, and my vision of her was she was selfish. See, the guys are laughing, right? They're like, yeah, I get it. Yeah. I just want to be honest. Yeah, I thought she was ruining my life. She was ruining my life. And they fired me that day, and it's so funny. I had a lot of pride, you know, and they fired me from this job that was beneath me, and I stormed out into the employee parking lot, even though I didn't have a car in the employee parking lot. I had a key to a car. I just didn't know where the car was. I'd been taking the bus to work, but I wanted to act like I still had my act together. So I went out to the employee parking lot. I walk all the way around the block to the bus stop. And it's ironic now. I didn't know it at the time, but across the street from this restaurant was an Alano Club. And I didn't know what that was, but next to the Alano Club was this civic center where at the time they were teaching young mentally retarded people, severely autistic people, how to live on their own. Pay their bills, and they were all there. So I walk up to the bus stop, and there's about 9 or 10 of these people And I'm standing at the bus stop, and I'm crying, and I got snot coming out of my nose. I can't believe I got this girl pregnant. I can't believe I lost a job. I got this knit tie on because I was going to bring those back single-handedly, and didn't work so well. It was actually the tie that was on the floor of my closet when I got that job. And I'm standing at this bus stop, and this bus just couldn't come fast enough. I was so humiliated. And I stepped off into Pacific Coast Highway to look down the street, and 10 mentally retarded people yelled, "Don't stand in the street! Don't stand in the street!" You know, and they scared the hell out of me. And because I thought they saw a bus. And I'd been seeing a lot of stuff that wasn't there. And so I jumped back, hoping I didn't get hit by the bus. And I realized that, you know, I went to college, and these people who were mentally challenged were, you know, better at waiting for a bus. I got on the bus, and I went home, and I tried to drink myself. And when I would get drunk enough, I put a gun in my mouth. And I'm a good Catholic school kid, so I'd always open the window behind me so that no one would have to clean up. I thought, I'll blow my brains out onto the lawn. I mean, that's, you know, sort of weird conscientiousness. You know, my poor mom's dying of cancer. There's this pregnant girl, but I don't want anyone to have a mess, you know. And that's just what went on, you know. And you know, I have to say, because I sponsored men in AA. I've heard a lot of fifth steps. I want to just say my mom and my dad were just really kind, loving, kind. I did not grow up in squalor. My father was an insurance agent. He worked till 9 or 10 o'clock at night so we could all go to college. My mom was a school teacher. My mom had quiet dignity. My dad was kind of a boisterous Irish guy. I loved them both. They did everything they could. They were such an example. My father loved my mother, and he always said, never said the ball and chain or anything like that. And he would say, best thing that ever happened. My mother was very loving, and I had this example. And, you know, I pushed that poor pregnant girl down a flight of stairs when she was 8 months. And I didn't do that because I wanted to hurt her. And I didn't want to hurt that baby. But the truth is, I didn't have a feeling in me for that. I couldn't even feel it. She wanted me not to drink that day. She didn't want me to quit. She wanted me not to drink because we had to go to the doctor. And I remember when she said, "Just, you know, you shouldn't drink today. We have to go to the doctor." I'd been drinking all night. And I felt like she was shouting. She wasn't. And I pushed her. And I meant to push her out of the doorway. But I knew that I pushed her too hard. So I slammed the door in my apartment because I didn't want the responsibility when I heard her fall down. So that's what it was like. I became an animal. I started off with everything, all love and support. You know, my brothers and sisters supported my musical career. My mother and father sent me to college and just taught me, you know, character and self-respect and work ethic. And I just pawned it all to pay for the money. That was about May 1st. And on May 14th or 15th, Mother's Day that year, and my brother, who was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 12 years, called me up and said, "Hey, it's Mother's Day, and we just want to make sure you're going to come." And I remember thinking, why would they think I'm not going to come? You know, maybe it was the 20 phone calls of, "I'm going to come visit you, Mom," but I didn't think about it. But I didn't want him to come in my apartment because it's kind of weird in there, you know. There were dishes in the sink from the Reagan administration, you know, and I got into making collages at about 3 in the morning, and there was some questionable stuff on my walls. There were bottles all over the floor, and so I ran outside so he wouldn't see my apartment, and he took me to King Harbor Yacht Club in Redondo Beach. It was a brunch. Mother and father were there. My brothers and sister were there. Everybody came from out of town because it might be Mom's last Mother's Day. And my brother, when he saw me, no one had seen me for 6 or 7 months, and he saw me, he was stunned to silence. And I didn't realize that I weighed 100. I didn't realize that you could see my skeleton. Breath smelled like fire. It was just business as usual. And when we got to the brunch, I walked inside, and I was trying to keep up a front. I'd been up all night drinking. And I was talking and babbling and not making sense. And everybody just closed the circle away from me. Stop talking to me. You know, I've had so many moments of bitter and incomprehensible demoralization. I've had so many. I've done things to people that I just really never thought I'd ever do. I've let things be done to me that I never thought I'd let. But for some reason, that moment with my parents and my brothers and sister, my youngest, that was the worst one. I don't know why. Just being honest. If you saw the movie, you'd go, oh no, that was not the worst one. Because there was some really horrible stuff that happened. I've told you, like the tiniest tip of the iceberg. But that was the worst one for me. I felt all alone in the whole universe, not just the world. I felt full of self-loathing and hatred. My brother took me home, and on the way home, we got in a fight, an argument. We don't know what it was about. We've discussed this since. We don't know what it was about. And I remember wanting to win the argument, and I felt like I could. And when he pushed me out of his car and said, just get out of here. So mad at me. I went into my, it wasn't about what I said at the brunch. It wasn't about how I looked. It was about some random thing. Irish people are like that. Sorry, Marcus. But I wanted to win. So I went inside and I waited for him to get home and I called him up and started screaming. I had all my arguments. You know, it's just great. I haven't visited my mom in 7 months. I haven't had a job. I owe everybody money. I've got warrants out for my arrest, and my sober brother with 12 years sobriety, doing all the right stuff, I'm going to win on moral higher ground. I really thought that. I really did. Aren't we astonishing? You know, our self-centeredness is mind-boggling. You know, it is. And I'm like the poster boy of self-centeredness. And so he listens because it wasn't really a debate. I was just going to tell him. And when I was done talking, very quietly said into the phone, I think you might have a problem with alcohol. And I look at this as a moment of grace in my life, and I don't mean that. I mean, people had said that to me, you know, band managers and friends, and I remember I was going to marry this girl for about 5 minutes till her dad took me for a walk, and, you know, there's always sorts of people telling me I had this problem, but I knew what alcoholism looked like. It looked like my brother. He lived in his car. He got sober, you know, and so my brother said that to me. The moment of grace wasn't that he said that. The moment of grace was that for some reason, out of my mouth, and I don't know why, I really don't know why, I could swear to God I wasn't going to say this, but I said, worse. And I worked the first step, and I didn't know it. I admitted it out loud. I knew it. You know, every day of that pregnancy and that unemployment and that cancer at my mother's house, I told myself every morning, I'm not going to. I'm going to get a job today. I'm going to go see mom today. I'm going to go visit the parents of that girl and make it okay. And every day got earlier and earlier and earlier. Just would start drinking. And I didn't know how. I didn't have any money, but I got money. I didn't have any way to do it. And then I would just find myself drinking. And, you know, I realize now, being around Alcoholics Anonymous for 18 years and working with a lot of hopeless alcoholics, that I might as well have said, today I'm going to hold back the Pacific. I just didn't know that. I thought that I could stop, and I couldn't. So my brother said, you might have a problem with alcoholism. I said, of course I do. And then he said the funniest thing anyone ever said to me. He said, don't go anywhere. And I went, oh, okay, you know. I'll clear my calendar, you know. I was going to move over to that side of the couch because I've been sitting here for 4 months, you know. And I got to go to the bathroom eventually, but I won't go anywhere. And he didn't realize how funny that was. And I swear to God, I didn't laugh, but I swear to God, he was in my door in like 10 minutes. He lived across town. Bam. And he walked in the door and he inhaled and he goes, hey, let's go to the beach. I don't know. Kind of ripe in there. And we went down to the beach. And I remember I grabbed a pack and a half of Marlboro Reds. I always think that's such an important thing. I don't know why, but I just remember. And we went down to the lifeguard stand at Avenue A in Redondo Beach. And I thought my brother was going to beat me up. I thought my brother was going to kick me. And, you know, the whole time he was coming over, I thought that's what he was. I thought he'll kick my ass and I'll never drink again. He'd done stuff like that before. And you know, I think you can probably understand, I kind of hoped he would. You know, because I've described to you so little, really, about what it was like. And on the outside of my life, it was a moonscape. It was, everything was burned to the ground. But in here, it was 10,000 times uglier than anything you could come up with. Right? So I was kind of hoping he'd do that. But he didn't do that. He did this amazing thing. He sat on the other side of the lifeguard stand, and I remember lighting the cigarette and looking at him, waiting for him to start yelling. He didn't. He looked at me for a long time, and he was quiet. And then he started talking to me about how he felt. My mom and dad kicked him out of the house when he was 18. Such a big day in our house. We just didn't. He had done enough. And I remember that day because I was 11 years old. It made me so sad. And he started talking to me about how he felt when the girl he got pregnant in high school and his son kicked him out of their house and said, never come back. Never come back. And I remember that day because I was about 14 years old and he called me. The only person he had left to call in the world was me, his little brother. Sobbed from his guts. When I was 14, I didn't know how to handle it. I remember saying, you should stop drinking. He said, you don't understand. He started talking to me about how he felt that day. He started talking to me about how he felt when he lived in his car. I remember when he lived in his car because I was 16. I used to go to school and I'd try to find his car so I could look in and see if he was still alive. So I just loved him. He played the drums. He looked like Paul McCartney. He was the coolest guy who ever walked the earth. He was living in his car. Broke his arm, didn't go to the hospital. So I remember that. And right in the middle of all that, he described exactly perfectly, to the T, how I felt sitting on that lifeguard. And I didn't think anybody knew in the world how I felt. The last guy I expected to know how I felt was him. I don't know why. And I was so disarmed by that. And I wanted to be. He could tell the truth. Couldn't tell the truth. He was going to see mom. He had a job. He bought a house. He had kids. I just wanted to be on his side of the lifeguard stand. I wanted to get to his side of the lifeguard stand. And I didn't know how. And I'd love to tell you that I had a moment of clarity. But what happened is I ran out of cigarettes. And he just kept talking. And I thought, Jesus, he's going to, you know. So I raised my hands and I said, you know, man, you're right. I got to go to AA. And then this wise Buddha of my brother became my Irish Catholic sarcastic brother, and he looked at me and he laughed. He laughed right in my face. He went, dude, you're not going to AA. You're going to a hospital. And I looked at him, and with complete seriousness, I said, man, I cannot do that. I am very busy. You know, anybody else busy, you know? I said, there's no way I can do that. I said, well, how long? He goes, I don't know, like 28 days. I'm like, yeah, ho, 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 ho. I cannot leave all this for 28 days. The balls will fall, you know. The plates, someone spins the plates. You know, and I look back on that, and what was I thinking? Like, you know, man, who's not going to pay the bills of that apartment? I am the guy not paying the bills right now. You know, who's not going to answer the phone? I don't answer the phone there. It's my job. So I was too busy. And he looked right over my head like, okay, whatever. And he's looking over my head. And later on, I said, you looked right over my head. He said, I was trying to get you to rehab before you died. He said, you look like you're going to die. And he walked me up to my apartment. He actually said those words. I was fumbling for my keys. I hadn't locked that apartment in years. But you know how we get, like, busy? I don't want anyone to notice that I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I'm standing there, and he looked at me for a minute, walking back to his car, and he goes, we're going to get you in someplace. Don't. And I thought he knew about the gun. And I got embarrassed. So on May 15th, 1993, I started getting ready for rehab, you know. I'm not a slacker. I don't want you to get the wrong impression. And, you know, and I passed out on the floor right next to the phone. And on May 16th, 1993, the phone rang, and I thought it was him. So I made the mistake of answering it, and it wasn't him. And I used to be able to say that I didn't know who it was. It was this woman. But I met her at a party 6 months later. She told me it was her. And this woman said into the phone, Matthew, we've been looking all over for your daughter with you, trying to get you to come to the hospital. And I forgot about her. And I said, oh, okay, I'll come to the hospital. And I was wearing these OR pants, these hospital pants. And I had this T-shirt on it and a hole in it. And I had flip-flops on. I know this is Thailand, but that's not cool in Redondo Beach to go to the hospital like that. And I ran out looking for my car with the key, you know, like, here, car, 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 you know, well, I don't know what I was thinking. And I found it. It took forever. And this is, you know, I'm the poster child for self-centeredness. And this is just perfect. I went to the hospital where I was born. Because that's where babies come from, right? You know, they weren't there.
Yeah.
But I was at the baby hospital, and all 108 pounds of me pounding on the counter going, look again, you know. And they were not intimidated. And they said, sir, we have no idea what you're talking about. And so I walked back out to my car, and I remembered. Anna had told me what happened about 50 million times, but I knew it. And I went to the right hospital, and I ran up to the elevator, and I got to the right floor, and I'm looking at the numbers, and I'm not thinking. I have no idea what's about to happen. I'm not prepared. And I see the right number, and I turn into this room, and Anna's in there. And she's happy to see me. And the last time I saw her, I pushed her down a flight of stairs. I was so embarrassed. I was so humiliated. I just wasn't thinking. And she jumped up, and she's coming at me. And I'm thinking, oh, no, she's going to hug me. And I smell bad. And I don't like her. And I'm a bad person. And she stopped right in front of me. And I thought, oh, thank God. And she turned, and she leaned into this plexiglass rectangular box and pulled out an angel of God. Phoebe Rose. She handed me this baby. And Phoebe was perfect, you know. I don't know if you've had any experience with this, but they got like miniature everything. You know, like little fingers and stuff. And she's looking up at me, and she's pure. She's so pure. She's brand new. And Anna's beaming at me. And I just felt filthy. I didn't feel miracle of birth. I didn't feel connected. I felt like I wanted to die. And I looked at them, and I prayed. I prayed. My prayer was, I hope these two women never see me again. I'm going to do something stupid. I'm not even going to mean to do it. And I'm going to hurt them.
I already did it.
I already almost killed them. But I'd forgotten about it. And I left. I lied. I was in that room. And I told Anna, I lied. I said, everything's going to be fine. And I really was planning on going home and shooting myself. It was the plan. But my brother bummed me out. He was sitting on my porch. I was going back to plan A, and he's there with plan B. And he was mad. He's like, where the hell have you been? That my daughter was. And he didn't say anything. He didn't congratulate me. Serious and sad. Said, I packed your bag. I went to a hospital. 28 days later, I came. All I remember from that hospital is I gained 40 pounds. I really don't know. I know I was really thin. And I was hungry, and I was tired, and confused. And I came out of that hospital, and my brother drove me home. And he said, hey, we get to his, well, actually, I drove his car, but we got to in front of my apartment, and he goes, go to a meeting. And I remember thinking, oh right, I'm going to go to a meeting. Now, I got 28 days, man. I got to go see Mom. I got to go see Phoebe. I got to get a job. But I'll go to a meeting. I remember thinking these AA guys are so intense, you know. And I went into my apartment, and somebody handed me a beer. Yeah, well, actually, it wasn't a beer. It was a Coors. And I stood there looking at it, and I put the beer down, and I ran away from my apartment. And if you're new here, I want you to know why. It wasn't because I had a foundation recovery. There's two reasons. One is I had 30 days of sobriety. All I had. I didn't have self-respect. I didn't have any money. I owed everybody money. I didn't have any friends. All these people in my apartment didn't visit me while I was living there by myself. And they were all partying in there. And I put it down and I left because I wasn't going to blow it at that moment. Those guys. I might have gone to a bar right then. I didn't know. But I ran to a payphone and I called AA. My life. I called AA and I went to an AA meeting. There was an AA meeting right across the street. It's so weird, you know. I remember, this is a true story. I called the guy. I couldn't find AA, first of all. I have a degree in literature. I can't find it in the phone book. I thought it was in the back under embarrassing stuff you want to look up when you're really desperate. And it's in the Z's. And it wasn't. I found it. And I called AA and I tell the guy, I'm talking about minutes. I told the guy everything I told you so far. You know, I was a rock star, maybe 108 pounds, you know, cancer, Coors. And this poor guy, he listens to this whole thing and he goes, yeah, where are you? You know? And I said, well, I'm on the corner of Burl and Catalina. And he said, oh, okay. And he's flipping through these papers. And he goes, oh, my God, that's so weird. I said, what? And he goes, there's a meeting right across the street from there. It starts in 15 minutes. And I said, what do you think I should do? I don't want to do anything drastic, you know. I thought he was going to help me, you know. I told him my detailed information because I wanted help. And I didn't want to, it's great you guys are getting together, but I need help, you know. And I went to that meeting. And I remember the speaker that it was, they used to wear, he got up at the podium. There's a lot of big speaker meetings in L.A. This had about 500 people there. I sat in the one chair in the middle of the room that had a bright spotlight on it, you know. And I'm sure you're all talking about me and pointing at me. And I sat down and the guy, I'll never forget it. The guy got up and he held the podium and he went, wah, 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 you know. And I'm looking around, and you guys are all laughing. And he's like, wah, 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 wah. And I'm like, I am so scared. Because I don't even know what he's saying. And then he pointed to the wall and said, these are tools for living. So I started reading those, and I'm like, oh, I need a tax step. I need an attorney step. I need a how to change a baby step. I need to cure cancer pretty quick here. And you got... And I got it. The guy stopped, and I got up to leave, and a guy stopped me and said, aren't you Neil's little brother? And I said, yeah. And he's a friend of my brother's. Can I give you a ride home? He said, sure. And we walked out to his car, and as we're walking out to his car, I'm slowing. He keeps walking. He finally turns around and goes, hey, man, what's your problem? And I go, I don't think I have a home. He said, what do you mean? And I told him about the beer, and there was a bunch of other stuff. And he said, well, we can't go there. He said, don't your parents live here? We were talking about dinner. I said, you know, yeah, they live 2 miles that way, but we can't go there. And I want to talk to you if you're in the first year of sobriety. I wish somebody would explain. And I'm totally serious. There was my perception of reality. My perception of reality was, I cannot go there. At that point, my parents were married for 45 years. Madly in love with each other. My mom's dying of cancer. My dad is beside himself. Their loser son, fresh out of rehab with an illegitimate child, is not showing up on their door today. That's the worst possible thing that can happen to them. It's embarrassing and humiliating. It's humiliating for me. That's my perception. Can't go there. So the guy dropped me off at my parents' house, and you guys don't listen, you know. And then he drove away. And so I knocked on the door, and my parents opened the door, and they were happy to see me. Like the kind of happy you can't. Like I poured out of them. And what was really happening there, the reality, my perception, you heard my perception, reality was those people were married to each other for 45 years. They were madly in love with each other. My mom's dying of cancer. My dad's beside himself. And the one guy that keeps them awake at night because they're worried showed up on their door. He had 30 days of sobriety, and he said, help me. It was their dream. They couldn't wait. They pulled me inside. I got my old bedroom back. There was still a poster of Eric Clapton that I put up there when I was 14 years old. I'm like, I'm back, Eric, you know. And I lived there. And in the morning, I got up, and I was terribly uncomfortable. Terribly uncomfortable. So I went to my parents and I said, I got this directory. There's a meeting. Dad, it's 7:30. Can I borrow the car? And he said, if you're going to a meeting, you can take the car. So I ran out to the car because I had to leave the uncomfortable place. And then I found the second most uncomfortable place. You guys, you know. Because I don't know you. You know, I walked in, everyone's talking about me and pointing at me, you know. If you're new, I just want you to know, we know that you think that. The truth is, you just landed in the group of the most self-centered people in the world. We may accidentally be looking your way, but we are preoccupied with ourselves. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yeah. So just relax. Yeah. All is well. But I can't even begin to tell you the amazing things that happened. I want to tell you, I got a sponsor, you know, in like the third meeting. I went to a meeting at noon and night, morning, noon and night, morning, just to get away. And then I'd go and sit with my dad, and my mom would fall asleep. Chemo, cry in my arms. Taught me about love. You know, I lived with them for almost a year, and you know how many times they brought up my sins in the past? Zero. Because they loved me, gave me. They just wanted me to be well. I got this sponsor, and I remember walking to his car, and he was walking to his car. No, I'm walking away from his car. We're going into a meeting, and I go, you know, I love Phoebe so much. I can't believe how much I love Phoebe. It's like a miracle. I thought it was the worst thing. I think I had like 60 days of sobriety. I thought it was the worst thing. You know, maybe it's the best thing. And he just walked right by me into the meeting. And I remember thinking, I actually thought, I did not know he was deaf in his left. You know? Got to remember that. Stand on the right side. And, you know, and I'm self-centered and insecure, and I'm looking across the room the whole time. Does he still like me? Does he still like me? You know? And then the meeting's over, and we're walking out to his car, and I'm standing on his right side, and I go, maybe you don't get it because you don't have kids, but I love this girl more than I love myself. And he turns to me, puts his hand up in my face, and he goes, man, how much child support are you? And I go, well, I work at a newspaper from midnight to 4 in the morning stacking papers on a loading dock. I deliver packages from 6 in the morning till noon, and I live with my parents. He goes, that's all fantastic information. How much child support? I said, you know, I don't pay any. He said, kind of full of it. He said, this is a program of action. He said, you must know it's a program of action. You go to 7 gazillion meetings a week. We talk about it all the time. He said, Matthew, don't tell me again you love me. Don't ever tell me that again. Just show me and I'll know. No, so it was a real quiet drive back to my house. You know. He's living in the present moment, and I'm planning his death, you know. And I go into my parents' house, and I storm down to the hall. I got to talk to Eric, you know. And I need a new sponsor, right? Clearly, this guy is not sensitive. And I'm pacing around my bedroom, like telling him off in my head and stacking my arguments. And Eric says, maybe he's right. And that's why my face was. Just told me the truth. There's no evidence that I love this girl. There's emotion. Love's a verb. Love's a verb. So I called up Anna, who, by the way, 18 years later, that was exactly right. She was in college. Anna was great. So I called up Anna and I said, hey, I don't make much money, but I should give you some money. And she said, that would be so great if you do that. I said, well, how much do you want? And, you know, I really could never move away from my parents' house. I thought I was going to be happy, joyous, and free and live in my old bedroom. Because of my crappy job. Remember your first year, right? So she could have said, I want it all. But she said, you know, let's not do an amount. Let's do a percentage. And I'm like, okay. That sounds fire. And she was betting on my horse. See, I didn't get it. I thought the horse was lame. So she asked for a very reasonable percentage. And every 2 weeks, I paid her. Every 2 weeks, I went to that house and I paid her. And I want to be totally honest about why I did that. I did not do it because I wanted to be a good parent. I'd love to tell you that's true. I did it for two reasons. One is I never wanted to drink again. And my sponsor sort of made it seem like they were connected. And the second reason was the only spiritual experience I had my first year of sobriety was holding communion. And it's hard to walk by the parents of a teenage girl and go hold your daughter when you're not paying attention. So I was paying my ticket, paying my way. But what happened is after about 6 months, I'd walk into a speaker meeting and you guys didn't jump up and applaud. You know, and I'm reading the grapevine, like, where's the Matthew Page child support? He's a hell of a guy article, you know. Why is this not on the news? Yeah. And everybody laughs at me. I got the turn. I felt the turn of the tide right there. You're not laughing with me anymore. But let me bring it home. Remember when you got your driver's license? You're sober like a year. You get your driver's license, you get your insurance, and you walk up to your special buddy in AA and go, hey, I got my driver's. And I go, hey, you're 40 years old, you know? Wow! You know? But we want a parade, you know? But what happened is, after a while, Anna did go off to college. Before she went, I was playing with you, and I was saying, I'm your dad. I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade. Second grade. Third grade. And when you're 16, I'm going to buy you a car. I'm going to save money so you can go to college, baby. You're going to know me for the rest of your life. Isn't that wonderful? 9 months before that, I prayed that she never see me again. And I was right to pray that. But I did these actions in AA. I did these actions. And I didn't get clean. I got clean enough for the next day. Clean enough for the next day. And I was madly in love with her. And I'm still mad. When we went to college, she said, Dad, can I drive with you? I didn't marry her mom. Her mom drove behind us. And Phoebe drove with me. She just wanted to be with me. I taught her how to play guitar. We send music to each other. We talk to each other 3 times on the phone every week because she calls me. She wants me to come up. She joined a sorority, which is kind of not like us. But, she wants me to go to Dad's. I don't know how that happened. I was an animal. I want to tell you a couple other things. One important thing in my sobriety was I was raised Catholic. I was drug up Catholic by the witches of God, you know, nuns. And so I have this some weird scar tissue, and that's all entirely in my head. But it's still there. I mean, that's great. You know, tell me it's in my head. I just get it out. And at the 11th step, I was doing the steps, and they were tools for me. I was doing everything. And I went to my sponsor at the 11th step, and I said, man, I don't get this. It says, prayed only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. I don't understand that. How do I know God's will for me? That's so ambiguous. You know, because God, in my estimation, hated me. You know, I remember this nun looked at me when I was 14 years old. Sister Dennis Ann, she's dead. Sister Dennis Ann, and she looked at me, and I think she was looking at me. I was sitting in the front row of the class, and she said, do you know that if you're thinking about sex, you're going to go to hell? And I was like, oh, psst, you know. And then I looked around the room, and thought, God, it's going to be so crowded, you know, because I knew all those guys, you know. It's all we talked about, you know, and we just talked about it, you know. Catholic school kids. And so I thought God hated me because I was trying to be good, like they said, good looked, and it was physically impossible for me. And then by the time I got here, God really hated me because I'd given him some. But my sponsor, I said, what does that mean, knowledge of God's will for me? And then he didn't answer me right away, which I've always appreciated. A couple days later, I brought it up to him again. I said, you know, I really do want to do this right, but I don't understand that. He said, you know, I thought about what you said. He said, you know, I think when the alarm clock goes off, God's saying, Matthew, get up. You know, when a bill comes in the mail and it says, pay this amount, that's like God saying right to you, pay that amount. You know, when Phoebe's diaper needs changing, God's saying, time to change. He said, if you just do the next indicator, I think you're pretty secure. You're doing God's will. Like the lights came on, the door flew open. You know, and it seems so simple,
but it changed my life.
You know, some people have asked me when I've told that story before, well, what's the alternative to doing the next indicated thing? And you know, we all know it's the next grandiose plan, right? The next shortcut. So I just did that. I got up when the alarm went off, like, God says, get up. I went to work. I got better jobs and better jobs. I got a job at an airline at Qantas Airways. And it was so funny. This guy doesn't work there. It's okay. I prayed, and I was praying that prayer, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I told my sponsor, I'm praying that prayer, relieve me of the bondage of self. Because I feel like overloaded with the bondage of self. And he said, that's a great prayer, Matthew, but why don't you help God out? And I go, well, how do I help God relieve me of the bondage of self? He said, well, why don't you do something for somebody and not tell anybody? I thought, okay, all right, try that. So this is the Monday Night Men's Stag. I sit down. This guy walks in. We ask for out-of-towners. He raises his hand and says, my name's so-and-so. I'm visiting from Australia. I'm going to come once a month. And I thought, I'll remember that guy's name. You know, that will be my great altruistic act, you know, and I will be relieved of the bondage of self. And, of course, a month later, I forgot all about it. And I'm talking to one of my friends, and the guy walks in the room, and it was like a high school dance. I was running across the room, pushing people out of the way. I got to welcome this guy. And I said, hello. I named his name. I said, welcome back to the greatest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, wow, that really impresses me. He remembered my name. He said, what do you do for a living? And I said, well, I draft newspapers on a loading dock, and I deliver packages. You know, I'm a trained professional. I'm very fulfilled. And he said, why don't you come to my office? I made this little tiny baby step away from myself. God, it's happened to me over, over, over. In fact, that led to the greatest event of my life. On the way to work one day, when I was paying all these different amends and I'm trying to move out from my parents' house, I bought a beautiful car. My greatest love of my life. And I bought a Taylor Dan Curry model guitar with a single cutaway. And if you play guitar, you. But that's okay. I have self-esteem. I'm okay. And I got to work, and I was late for work. So I put it in my locker. And if you're a guitar player, you know what? I looked at the case. It was sexy, you know. It's sexy. It's brand new guitar, brand new case. I used to visit it during the day when I was working that night. I was like, hey, there she is. She's still in there, man. I'm going to get home. We're going to do some pretty kinky stuff. And I get out, and I'm standing at the bus stop at LAX for the employees. And I'm standing there with this guitar, and I'm like, I'm about to explode. I got to show someone. So I turn to the first person standing next to me. It's this woman. And I turn from British Airways, and I say, hey, can I show you my new guitar? And she, her eyes got a little big, and she looks at me, and she goes, I don't look at strange men's guitars. Yeah. And she gets on the bus, and I'm like, and I thought, oh, she thinks I'm hitting on her. I don't care who she is. I just want two eyes to look at this guitar, you know. So I get in the bus, and unfortunately for her, we're pressed against each other. Pat, right? So she's looking rather nervous, and she has a book in her hand called Surprised by Joy by C.S. Lewis. And I said, oh, I've read that book. She said, well, we'll cut to the chase. Do you believe in God? And I almost spit. I went, God saved my life, you know. Bad pickup line number two. And she just wanted to disappear. Like all the blood drained out of her face. And I'm like, Jesus, Matthew, have you never ever talked to a girl before? You know? So I realized, you know, ask her questions. You know, I said, so what do you think? And she said, I'm on the fence. We got into this really interesting talk about God. And as we're talking, I'm looking at her, I'm like, God, she's really pretty. Blue eyes, she looked like Audrey Hepburn. Not nervous. If you're a guy in here, you realize that's a spiritual awakening. She's hot and I'm not nervous. And we got off the bus and I said, you know, what do you think? Maybe we could forget about this guitar and maybe have dinner sometime. Ooh, whoa, she did not think so. She's like, all right. If you want to look at my guitar, I've read that book. She goes, look, I gotta wait for this bus every night. I don't need people hitting on me. Blah 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 blah, you know. But she was so cute, and she had this great British accent. I was torn, you know. And she storms off. And I knew that I had grown spiritually. Because I went to work the next day, And I didn't tell anybody she was a lesbian. That's totally her business. You know? I'm okay. She's okay. We're good. You know, it seems like I'm kidding, you know? But the point is, I liked me by then. And I was sad that I missed my shot. I was sad that I made her uncomfortable. But I liked me. I was clean inside. I was clean. I was sad. I went to work the next day and I only thought about her like 7. Hardly at all. And then I went to the bus stop thinking maybe she won't come to this bus. Maybe she's delayed and I don't have a guitar so she won't recognize. And this woman walks up and taps me on the shoulder and she says, you know, I think I was rude to you yesterday. I do not want to go out with you. She's so emphatic, you know. And she said, but why don't we have coffee tonight? Call it. Proposed to me 3 weeks later. We were married for 15 years. So a guy converts a lesbian and that's the best you can do? Miracles in AA. But, you know, we got married. My mother was very, very sick at the time, and we got married in Crystal Lake, Illinois, because my wife wanted to get my mom to go back home, Illinois. And she said, I don't care where we get married. Let's go where your mom is. Your dad can go. That's who I married. You know, I went to my sponsor before I married her, and I said, you know, she's not anorexic. She's not addicted to heroin. She's like, really not my type. You know. And he said, I know, you've changed, you know. And you attract better people when you're different. And I had character and I had self-respect and I had friends. I still owed everybody money. But we got married and that day we got married to this old house on the lake that my family since 20. And I walked down to the pier on the lake before she came out. And I looked up at the sky, beautiful sky blue. Beautiful white clouds. And I looked up and raised my hands up and I said, thank you, God, that this is the next indicated thing. Wow! You know, because, you know, sometimes the next indicated thing isn't a bill or a dirty diaper or an alarm clock. Sometimes the next indicated thing makes your heart blow up in your chest with joy. And I've had it over and over. You know, Philippa and I had 2 children together. First of all, she didn't want to have children, but she loved Phoebe so much. She said, let's have a go. I remember, let's have a go. And I said, you know, it's not like bowling. Like, if we don't like it, we don't get to give the ball back, you know. And then she said, with a glass of wine in her hand, this is your window, you know. I jumped right through the window. And we got Rory, and we got Sophie, and we got Phoebe. We didn't do that on purpose. Huey, Dewey, and Louie. We just, you know, that's the names we like. And, you know, I drove Philippa to the hospital where she was going to have the baby, and I had insurance. It's a remarkable feeling when you get a chance to do it. And I had these amazing things and good things, amazing things happen, beautiful things. But my mother died. People died. She died right in my arms. I watched her. But I was clean. I did my amends to her. I worked very hard at Alcoholics Anonymous. I was under the impression everybody, because my group made it seem mandatory. We didn't have Richard to read the steps. But they still seem very serious. And I did all this stuff, and my life bloomed. But, you know, I get afraid because I go to AA meetings, and we tell a lie in AA. We tell a lie here. And the lie we tell is, everything's going to be okay. That's a lie. If you're new here, we're not trying to lie to you. But I have to tell you the truth. It wasn't all roses. It wasn't all beautiful things. You know, I've had great joy, and I've had great sorrow. When I was married to Philippa for 5 years, I came home and found her on the floor. Had a massive stroke. She sustained permanent brain damage and she's paralyzed. All the way down her left side, she's completely paralyzed. I get to dress her. I get to undress her at night. I have to run the household. Sophie was one. I've had to take care of Sophie till she could. I had to change all the diapers. Because Philippa is still herself, but she's not all there. She's never going to be the same. For 10 years, my wife's been disabled and brain damaged. But I found a level of love and intimacy with this woman that I didn't know was possible. I certainly didn't know I had it in me. I'm not that deep. I'm shallow and self-centered. But I am madly in love with this woman. She has this wonderful sense of humor. One time in a fit of frustration, I'm not good at this. I said, baby, I just miss you. She said, baby, I miss me too. Hard to fight with that, you know. So when we say everything's going to be all right, we don't mean to lie to you. Things are going to be what things are going to be. Just because you got sober doesn't mean you're better than normal people. You're going to lose the job. You're going to get divorced, maybe. Maybe your wife's going to have a stroke. Maybe your mother's going to. We don't mean everything's going to be okay. We mean you're going to be okay no matter what. That's good. Because I wasn't okay when good stuff happened. And now I'm okay, you know. I came here an animal. I came here an animal. I pushed a girl down a flight of stairs and I didn't think twice about it. And I'm a human being. And all I did was those 12 suggestions. And I love this group. I love it. Thank you so much for letting me be here tonight.
Thank you very much, Matthew. And I think we were all thinking about our own feelings as you were sharing that, things that were personal to us as well. Thank you very much. Matthew is coming to speak tomorrow morning again at 10:30. And we have a Thai speaker as well, WeWat. That's at 10:30 here tomorrow morning. A couple of announcements. We found a box of cups. So some people registered and didn't get one of the free cups. So the people that registered and didn't get a free cup, come out to the registration area afterwards and we'll give you one. Tomorrow morning, we have an Al-Anon meeting at 9 o'clock and we have a Keep Coming Back meeting chaired by Bob. Tonight, we have some marathon meetings. I think I asked somebody if they'd chair the first one. Anyway, there we go. And they're going to be in the same place they were last night. So 10:30 tomorrow, the closing ceremony. Anonymity. Please remember that this is an anonymous program. Who you see here, what you hear here, when you leave here, please let it stay here. Also remember the 12th tradition stating that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Let us close with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference.